Log.
It's the Jenny Hatch Show on Blog Talk Radio, and I'm your host. Today's show is going to be the introduction to my blog. When I began blogging back in 2005, I made the decision to write quite a lengthy introduction to explain to my readers what the goals were for my blog. And I spent several weeks writing this introduction, and I really wanted to encapsulate the ideas and the agendas that I had for taking the time to write this blog. My blog is not just to share my life with people who happen to chance by or for my family and friends to see updated pictures of my kids. This blog is dedicated to the promotion of home birth, and my main goal is to help families, parents, mothers, fathers, learn how to wean from the worldly systems that are in place that are overpriced, overused, and deprive us of ultimate wellness and financial security. So I'm going to read this now. At about the halfway point, I'm going to sing the song, the lyrics to the song that is the theme for my show. This song is called Make Us One, and it was written by an LDS composer named Sally DeFord, who actually lives here in Colorado. Her website, if you just Google her name, Sally DeFord, you'll find it. She's graciously put all of her music up on the web for free downloads, and she has beautiful singers who have taken the time to put their own voices up. Plus, she has the MP3 audios of just the acoustical accompaniment so that those who want to sing can just use that as their accompaniment if they don't have a pianist to play for them. So I love her. I love her music. And the message of her song, Make Us One, was the message that I wanted to have for my radio show efforts. So I'll sing the lyrics to that, because I'm always playing this introductory music, but I'm sure you don't know the song because it's not very well known, and you might like to hear the lyrics. So at some point, after I read for a while, I'll go ahead and sing that. I wrote this post back in 2005 during the months of June and July. I had been chased out of the Mothering Magazine chat room for the final time. When I first started posting there, in 2 weeks I had been given several notices letting me know that they wanted me to stop baiting all the liberals. And they felt like I was a conservative troll who's just there to make trouble. I wasn't. I was there to talk and debate and let's talk about this thing called politics. But after just a few months, I finally got fed up and wrote a post that I knew would get me banned. And it was after that banning and after being kind of chased out or shouldered out of a couple of other chat rooms for moms that I just decided that my conservative views were not popular, and the moms, many of them that I was chatting with every day, they didn't want to hear what I had to say. And so I figured that writing my own blog where I couldn't be moderated or edited or chased out was probably the only way for me to participate on the Internet. And so that's why I started writing my blog. I have to say that the conservative chat rooms, especially Free Republic, while I have had posts and threads deleted for a variety of reasons, they have never banned me in all of my posting these past 7 years. And it's been my experience, and the conservative websites and chat rooms are much more tolerant of divergent views, no matter what they are, political, or I'm always talking about healthcare, but they are much more tolerant of the things that I write than any of the liberal moderated sites that I've participated on. Anyway, I started this blog because I kept getting chased out of places for sharing my views, and so here's the introduction. It was published on July 4th, Independence Day, 2005. And it begins with a quote from Benjamin Rush, who was a signer of the Declaration of Independence. He is also considered the father of modern psychiatry, which smacks me of being completely ironic because, if nothing else, my blog is devoted to the smashing and dismantling of the psychiatric profession. But anyway, here's his quote, and this is the theme of my blog. Unless we put medical freedom in the Constitution, the time will come when medicine will organize into an undercover dictatorship. to restrict the art of healing to one class of men and deny equal privileges to others. The Constitution of this Republic should make a special privilege for medical freedom as well as religious freedom. Dr. Benjamin Rush, signer of the Declaration of Independence, was the one who wrote this quote, and he's considered the father of modern psychiatry. While I agree with his famous quote about medical freedom, it is ironic that he is also considered the founder of a movement that enslaves just about everyone who touches it. Background. I have been researching and making plans for this blog for some time now, and decided it would probably be helpful for you, the reader, to understand up front that I do have an agenda. So I thought I would take the time in this first big post to outline my goals for this effort and also give you a sense of my writing style so that you don't have to waste 1 minute of your time trying to figure me out. My first goal is to inspire as many people as possible to give birth at home. Robert Mendelsohn said in his book, Confessions of a Medical Heretic, that the most revolutionary thing you can do is to fall in love, get married, and birth your children at home. I didn't really understand what he meant by that statement when I read it for the first time 16 years ago, but as the years have passed, I have come to agree with his analysis. And I hope that something I write along the lines of this thought will inspire you to give birth in your own home. I pray that by reading this blog, you will be inspired to get more fully into natural family living. I would like to encourage you to take full responsibility, first and foremost, for your own health and well-being. And I would like to challenge you to take more responsibility for the health of your family. Second goal. My second goal is to challenge you politically. I know that many American women feel drawn to liberalism and vote Democratic. It was said that the reason Bill Clinton, a known sex offender, was elected twice to the presidency was largely because of women voters. I think a good place to start when learning the facts about Bill Clinton would be to read this excellent new book, Their Lives, The Women Targeted by the Clinton Machine, by Candace Jackson. I would like to use this blog to encourage you, the reader, to go far beyond the warm, fuzzy, I feel your pain side of the Democratic Party and take a hard look at what it exactly stands for. I would like to use any powers of persuasion I possess to challenge you to move confidently into the neocon side of the Republican Party. I plan to share a variety of resources, links, and editorials written by some of the finest writers and thinkers of our generation in the coming months and years to educate you on why I believe it is imperative that we mothers understand these issues clearly so that when we vote, we know exactly the long-term effects of our political choices. My political history. I would like to give you a little background so you can understand clearly why I put myself comfortably into the neocon camp. I grew up in a very politically aware home. My parents are passionate conservatives. My dad is a patriot, and his hero is George Washington. My parents took the time to teach all 8 of us children the principles of freedom and used whatever means at their disposal to testify and share their belief that America was unique and expose us to the wonderful history of the United States. This was profoundly important at the time, because my parents were completely clueless about what was happening in our Michigan public schools during the 70s and 80s, where we were being systematically indoctrinated in socialism and Marxism at every juncture. As members of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, it is part of our theology that we as citizens of any particular country be politically involved, aware, and vote. The Church has never told us whom to vote for. It simply encourages awareness of the issues and to be a full participant. My parents took this seriously, and so I had the fabulous example of them carefully studying the issues and voting in each election. Additionally, I grew up in Michigan, where some members of our Detroit congregation were very politically involved. George Romney, yes, that is Mitt's dad, Romney in 08, was our governor. Later, a close family friend, Richard Headley, ran for governor in 1982. I worked on his campaign, and because his youngest daughter was my best friend, was invited to stay at the hotel with the family the night of the election, and I watched all of the election return excitement firsthand. This political activism as a young woman was crucial in shaping my thinking and making politics real and touchable. I became convinced early that the most important thing I could do was to educate myself on the issues, vote, and be involved to help elect my candidates and fight for the issues important to me. When I was in high school, my dad started watching a new cable channel, C-SPAN. He and I would discuss politics while watching C-SPAN in the evenings, and he would explain to me how important it was to listen to the politicians firsthand instead of getting a 30-second soundbite on the evening news. Later, during the early years of our marriage, I became a C-SPAN junkie. During political elections and other busy political seasons, I would watch for hours every day. As soon as we hooked up to the web at home, I made the gradual transformation that so many conservatives have made of getting my news from talk radio and the Conservative Chronicle to eventually getting 95% of my news from blogs and all of my favorite online news sites. I think Matt Drudge still has the best site on the web. Now, I only turn on the evening news when I am curious to see how they are spinning things. It always gives me a good chuckle. My longtime favorite writers include Phyllis Schlafly and Thomas Sowell. Ann Coulter has been a favorite for years, and lately Mark Stein consistently comes out on top in terms of analysis and humor. I consider myself a neocon for the simple reason that in the past I have been both of the L words. I was a liberal for 3 months during a period of teenage angst and crisis when I was 15. Then I went through a latency phase of not really caring about politics. A young man whom I admired was going through his Ayn Rand phase and encouraged me to read The Fountainhead. Thank you, Glenn. I was 18, just about to graduate from high school, and had been accepted to BYU. I planned to leave home 6 days after my graduation and attend summer school to get a jump on my college degree. A few weeks before graduation, I noticed a copy of The Fountainhead in my homeroom teacher's lending library, and I inhaled it in a week's time. When I returned the book to this same teacher, informing her that it was one of the best books I had ever read, she took one look at it, then smiled at me and said, "Well, that fits." I suppose I was already showing some early signs of libertarian thought and behavior. All right, now I would like to sing you this song. As I said, Sally DeFord, Make Us One, and I'm just singing into my phone, so I know it's not going to sound real great, but I just want you to hear the lyrics. So here it is. Thank you. I have this feeling it just sounds terrible, so I'm going to stop. I was going to sing the whole song, but I think I'll just put a link on this entry to the song on the internet so you can just hear it there, because it doesn't sound too good. Anyway, here's some more of my introductory post. I pick it up with the caption, More Political Biography. After I skipped through the world of Howard Roark, I borrowed, stole, my mother's copy of Atlas Shrugged, packed my bags for BYU, and left home for the first time. Thus began my libertarian phase, which lasted a few years and was an important period during my political evolution. Libertarian ideals and thought did not translate into voting for the libertarian candidates. I have always voted for Republicans, but I was highly influenced by Rand's world as outlined in her books, which, in case you were unaware, her objectivist philosophy laid the foundations for the Libertarian Party. It is difficult for me to describe the impact those books had on me and my thinking, especially since I had just finished up 13 years of Marxist thought, where we studied the Communist Manifesto more than the Constitution during my public school incarceration. It was this clarifying of exactly how socialism works in reality in Atlas Shrugged that was so profoundly important to my young mind. I read the book twice that summer of 86 and copied favorite quotes into my journal. Later, I read Anthem, We the Living, and a biography of Ayn. BYU is a conservative mecca, but I just happened to room with a Canadian self-declared card-carrying member of the Socialist Party for 11 months. I grew to love my roommate for her good qualities, and I still have fond memories of our time together, but her political views and absolute hate of Reagan really made for some interesting conversations. I didn't know enough at that point to truly defend my then-developing political worldview, but I am so grateful to Heather for her passion and her clarity on what she stood for, because even though we had nothing in common politically, she stretched me and helped me to understand how politically aware Canadians are and made me aware of how much people from other countries carefully follow American politics. I hardly knew who the head of state was in Canada, much less how Canadians voted or behaved politically. Living in the same room with her for all those months was a profound education in how people outside of America felt about us. I also was able to observe firsthand the impact that higher education has on the views and attitudes of those who have been systematically brainwashed in Marxism and taught that capitalism is evil. I believe the Canadians have carried these efforts to an art form in terms of the passionate leftist views of the majority of the Canadians I have met. Mark Stein is, of course, the great exception to this rule. I also had been brainwashed in these same studies, but for me they did not stick because of the excellent home education I received from my parents during the hours that I was not in school. Much was happening in the world of politics during 1986 and 87, but I spent those years completely cut off from the media while I wrapped myself up in my studies. As a musical theater major, I was very busy with rehearsals, auditions, and performances on top of my regular classes, and I just did not have time for following politics and being politically active. I didn't watch television and read no news magazines, and although I read the Daily Campus Paper and the Underground Campus Paper, I was really isolated in terms of media exposure. In the summer of 1987, I auditioned for a summer stock theater in West Yellowstone, Montana, and was chosen as one of the cast of 16 to perform 8 shows a week at the Playmill Theater. This company plays mostly to the tourists who flock to Yellowstone Park during the summer months. Again, I was completely isolated politically and had 4 months of no media contact. I reveled in the life of the actor, and although very busy with my performances and part-time jobs as a maid and a seamstress, I still found time to read dozens of books that summer. I read the Book of Mormon and once again dove into the Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged. I also stretched my brain by reading The Dancing Wooly Masters and Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance. These books are must-reads for any college freshman. I spent much time dreaming and planning for my future as an actor. I believe that with an equity card and a BYU degree, Broadway was definitely a possibility. I mapped out the steps that would need to happen in order for me to accomplish these goals in the shortest time possible. During the summer, I made the decision to go home to Detroit for a semester to work as a waitress in order to get to know my family again and to have a wad of cash to see me through a full year of school with no summer breaks. 3 weeks after I came home, I met my husband. I guess the easiest way to outline the next part of my life is to simply say that it is now 2005. We have been happily married for 17 plus years, have 5 kids, are both passionate conservative Republicans. I am a committed stay-at-home mother, and no, I never made it to Broadway. But I have dreams of going back to the theater and being a character actor when I'm a grandma. Just a sec, I need to get a drink. New directions. A few days after our first anniversary, we went through an experience which has shaped our politics and changed our worldview in profound and lasting ways. I wrote my first book, A Mother's Journey, to give all the details of this experience. But to summarize, 3 months after the birth of our first baby, I experienced a postpartum psychosis. Then I spent 2 years in varying shades of emotional illness. I was forced to experience the full range of psychiatric care available in the late 80s because of a court order. During one of the worst moments of my incarceration at the Michigan State Mental Hospital, which was Clinton Valley Center in Pontiac, Michigan, a few days before I was to go before the judge for my final treatment orders, I found myself locked in a seclusion room, singing patriotic hymns at the top of my lungs. Land of the free and the home of the brave. My country tis of thee, sweet land of liberty, and America, America, God shed his grace on thee. I knew that I was fighting a losing battle, and that I would probably be forced against my will to take the medications. I had been fighting the staff for 28 days not to take medications because I wanted to continue to breastfeed my daughter and did not want to have to stop in order to go on lithium. As I sang those songs of freedom, I felt a solidarity with anyone who had been locked up for any reason and forced to do something they were determined not to do. But the judge court ordered me to take the drugs, and I submitted to the long arm of the law. This was a life-changing experience for me. I completely support the efforts of all of the psychiatric survivors and would challenge you, the reader, to seriously consider the implications of how much power the psychiatric profession possesses, especially if you are a person of faith and believe in the supernatural world. By current psychiatric definitions, if you believe in personal revelation, being prompted by the still small voice of the Holy Ghost, and are open to the ideas of angels ministering in our world, by definition, you are a psychotic in need of treatment. Some of these beliefs, especially personal revelation through the gift and power of the Holy Ghost, which is a cornerstone of Mormon doctrine, were used against me by the main doctor who diagnosed me to justify forced treatment. He told me that my belief in personal revelation was evidence that I had been mentally ill my whole life, but was only now showing the outward signs of it. The police in my hometown had picked me up in my underwear. In a psychotic state, I had been singing hymns on a sidewalk and had cast Satan out of the world so the millennium could start. After 14 months of being forcibly drugged, I found a psychiatrist who was willing to help me wean off of the chemical cocktail I had been court-ordered to eat. This doctor saved my life. Thank you, Elaine. With her compassion and competence, after stopping the meds, I began the slow process of learning how to be well. Part of that learning was to figure out how the medical profession had garnered so much power, enough power to keep me locked up for 6 weeks against my will and then force me to take their dope. I believe then, and I still believe, that 95% of the cause of me going psychotic when my daughter was 3 months old was simply from sleep deprivation. Dr. Anne Blake Tracy helps to shatter the conventional wisdom that giving psychiatric drugs to sleep-deprived mothers who are in a psychotic state is the best course of action. It is, in fact, the absolute worst thing that can happen to a mother if the heart of her mental illness is, in fact, sleep deprivation. And I believe it is the reason why I fought so hard not to take the drugs when they were being forced on me. I eventually went to court and lost after a 28-day battle of wills not to take the drugs. Now, I'm going to insert something here away from the introduction. In the last few years since I wrote this introduction, I have learned much more about the true causes of postpartum psychosis. And I still believe that my claim that a huge part of it was sleep deprivation, simply because with my other three children who I had after my first, I didn't fall into psychosis, and I absolutely focused in on getting my sleep and taking care of my physical body. It was about 8 years ago that I started to heal from all of the childhood sexual abuse that I suffered from, and it was about 4 years ago that I started to remember the most noxious assaults that took place during my childhood that I now believe are the true cause of why I lost my mind after my baby was born. I'm not going to take the time or energy to point fingers, but I will say that from the age of 7 until I was 14, I was raped over and over again by someone in my life. And when that happens, sometimes it causes a lot of mental distress. I still believe the best way to treat that distress is with nutrients, calcium, magnesium, progestins, progesterone, natural progesterone, vitamins, minerals, whole foods, and sleep are the best ways to treat someone who has fallen into that dark place. But I've sort of backed away from my sleep deprivation being the main cause of it, because when I typed this, I really wasn't aware of how much I had been sexually assaulted when I was just a little girl. So just a little tangent on this introduction, but I'll go back now to the text of what I wrote. Why medical freedom? I began reading books, many, many books. Books and articles on politics, freedom, government, the history of the medical profession, and the relationships that exist between the pharmaceutical companies and government. Peter Breggin's books have been the most helpful to me. Reading Talking Back to Prozac was the first step to getting off the meds and starting me down the path to learning how to be well. My local pharmacist, who had been dispensing the antidepressant to me, recommended that book to me. One more tangent. When I wrote this introduction, I just wrote it off the top of my head. But a few years ago, I went back and just wanted to make sure everything I said was absolutely correct. Peter Breggin wrote that book, Talking Back to Prozac, a couple of years after I came off the meds. And while my local pharmacist did have some anti-drug books on his shelf, it was actually an article in the Newsweek magazine on Prozac that was a pro-Prozac article that got me thinking I wanted to get off the drugs. So just a little clarification there. My personal experience has fueled this quest to learn for myself the bitter truth about psychiatry better than any casual or passive perusal of that topic ever could have. Without that upfront and in-person view of the tortured world of the psych patient and the experiences I had during my various lockups, and I've been in mental hospitals 4 times, I never would have considered taking the time or putting out the energy to learn the facts. One more insertion. It is often the family members of psychiatric patients who believe they are the most knowledgeable and educated about the psychiatric industry. Almost all of the psychiatric support groups that are out there have been started by family members, the parents, the siblings, the spouses of those who are psychiatric patients, and almost all of those groups are funded by pharmaceutical companies. And most of them believe in the meds. And so you have these two groups. You've got the actual patients, of which I'm one, and then you've got the family members who think they know everything about mental illness, and they really don't. And you've got the two kind of butting heads. And I have come down firmly on the side of the psychiatric survivors who claim that all psychiatric meds, treatments, are forms of torture and coercion and need to be done away with in our modern society. All right, I'll go back to the introduction. My personal experience has fueled this quest to learn for myself the bitter truth about psychiatry. From this education, which continues today, I have developed a deep loathing for the monopoly the allopathic model of medicine currently enjoys in our world, especially in America. In 1989, I was trained and certified as a Bradley childbirth teacher and began teaching childbirth classes in my home. From 1989 to 1996, I had a profound education in the politics of childbirth. During that time, I also gave birth to 3 more children and enjoyed the association and friendship with fellow childbirth educators, childbirth pioneers, authors, and activists. I have researched the medical monopoly, especially in regards to psychiatric care and birth, and have come to believe that some major monopolies need to be broken up. I believe Benjamin Rush was quite prophetic when he claimed the day would come when we would need medical freedom guaranteed by our Constitution. I don't know when, how, or if this is possible given the current political climate, but I, for one, plan to spend the rest of my days working diligently for a medical freedom amendment to the Constitution to be ratified. When one considers the taxpayer money that has been infused into this one branch of healing, the dollars spent on research, funding of institutions, suppression of competing healing modalities, and the socialized aspects of medicine, with Medicare and the health care offered by the military, it befuddles the mind to consider the outlay of cash that we the people have been forced to put out to prop up this medical monopoly that is currently enjoyed by the allopathic model. But we were warned. I need to get a drink. A prophet's warning. John, in the book of Revelations, warned about the power of the sorceries in the last days. He said, "By thy sorceries were all nations deceived." It is interesting to note that the Strong's exhaustive concordance claims that the Greek word pharmakeia means medication, pharmacy, and pharmakeis from pharmakon, drug, spell-giving potion, means a druggist, a pharmacist, or a poisoner, by extension, a magician. Webster's New Collegiate Dictionary definitions for relevant words include pharmaceutical, from Greek. I have no idea how to say this word. Pharmakoutikos, a medicinal drug. Pharmako, Greek pharmako, from pharmakon, to medicine or a drug. Pharmacology is the science of drugs. Pharmacy, from the Greek pharmakeia, the art or practice of preparing, preserving, compounding, and dispensing drugs. A place where medicines are compounded or dispensed, a drugstore. By Strong's definition, the word sorceries could be describing pharmaceuticals dispensed by pharmacists. The word sorceries in the following verse is the King James Version translation of the Greek word pharmakeia, and this comes from Revelations chapter 18, verses 21 through 23. And a mighty angel took up a stone like a great millstone and cast it into the sea, saying, "Thus with violence shall that great city Babylon be thrown down and shall be found no more at all." And the voice of harpers and musicians and of pipers and trumpeters shall be heard no more at all in thee, and no craftsman of whatsoever craft he be shall be found any more in thee, and the sound of a millstone shall be heard no more at all in thee. And the light of a candle shall shine no more at all in thee. And the voice of the bridegroom and of the bride shall be heard no more at all in thee. For thy merchants were the great men of the earth, for by thy sorceries were all nations deceived. End of quote. How is it possible for one method of healing to grasp so much power, especially in the field of obstetrics and psychiatry? The story is long and painful to read, but the bottom line is that we the people have been sold a chemical mess of pottage in exchange for our birthright of empowered, healthy living. The prophet Daniel, I have an interpretation of scripture that I have never read anywhere else and have really never shared it in any public forum. I cover this topic in depth in my book, Elijah Birth, but here is a short synopsis shared for you to ponder as I have for the past 10 years. I believe what needs to happen in the future in order for us to break free of the current medical bondage we find ourselves in, and I would like to offer the idea that most people do not even consider the allopathic model of healthcare as being a form of bondage, is that we first need to come to an understanding that medical birth and psychiatric care have become so distantly removed from what is natural and normal, we have easily come to fulfill the prophet Daniel's prophecy wherein he claimed a little horn would make war with the saints. This is from Daniel chapter 7, verses 18 through 28. But the saints of the Most High shall take the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever, even forever and ever. Then I would know the truth of the fourth beast, which was diverse from all the others, exceeding dreadful, whose teeth were of iron and his nails of brass, which devoured, break in pieces, and stamped the residue with his feet, and of the 10 horns that were in his head, and of the other which came up, and before whom they fell, even of that horn that had eyes, and a mouth that spake very great things, whose look was more stout than his fellows, I beheld, and the same horn made war with the saints, and prevailed against them, until the Ancient of Days came, and judgment was given to the saints of the Most High, and the time came that the saints possessed the kingdom. This he said, the fourth beast shall be the fourth kingdom upon earth, which shall be diverse from all kingdoms, and shall devour the whole earth, and shall tread it down, and break it in pieces. And the 10 horns out of this kingdom are 10 kings that shall arise, and another shall rise after them, and he shall be diverse from the first, and he shall subdue 3 kings, and he shall speak great words against the Most High, and shall wear out the saints of the Most High, and think to change times and laws, and they shall be given into his hand until a time and times and the dividing of time. But the judgment shall sit, and they shall take away his dominion to consume and destroy it unto the end. And the kingdom and dominion and the greatness of the kingdom under the whole heaven shall be given to the people of the saints of the Most High God, of the Most High, whose kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and all dominions shall serve and obey him. Hitherto is the end of the matter. As for me, Daniel, my cogitations much troubled me, and my countenance changed in me, but I kept the matter in my heart. End of quote. Do I believe the medical profession is the little horn that is making war with the saints, befuddling natural laws, stamping residue with his feet, and seeking to change times and seasons? Yes, I do. Over the years, I have read many interpretations of these scriptures in Daniel and Revelations, and I believe the medical profession and all of its supporting sub-corporations fit perfectly. Listen to this next chapter of Daniel. What and who do you think he is describing? Daniel chapter 8. Verses 19 through 27. And he said, Behold, I will make thee know what shall be in the last end of the indignation, for at the time appointed the end shall be. The ram which thou sawest having 2 horns are the kings of Media and Persia, and the rough goat is the king of Grecia, and the great horn that is between his eyes is the first king. Now that being broken, whereas 4 stood up for it, 4 kingdoms shall stand up out of the nation, but not in his power. And in the latter time of their kingdom, when the transgressors are come to the full, a king of fierce countenance and understanding dark sentences shall stand up. And his power shall be mighty, but not by his own power. And he shall destroy wonderfully, and shall prosper and practice, and shall destroy the mighty and the holy people. And through his policy also, he shall cause craft to prosper in his hand, and he shall magnify himself in his heart, and by peace shall destroy many. He shall also stand up against the prince of princes, but he shall be broken without hand. And the vision of the evening and the morning which was told is true. Wherefore, shut thou up the vision, for it shall be for many days. And I, Daniel, fainted and was sick certain days. Afterward, I rose up and did the king's business, and I was astonished at the vision, but none understood it. That's the end of the quote. I would suppose that many who read this, especially my LDS brothers and sisters who have such faith in medicine, might become quite angry at this interpretation of Scripture. And I have read many interpretations of this passage, the most common being that the 10 horns are the European Union. But you know what? the European Union is busting up even as I write. I have read other interpretations, but none of them really fit the imagery of the passage. I believe we need to get out of the hole we have been thrust into and consider that instead of political parties, governments, or countries, the ten horns are multinational corporations reaping a bounteous harvest off of the ignorance and trust of individual families because of our willingness to march lockstep in obedience to the prescribing of doctors and the pharmaceutical companies that give them their marching orders. I would ask you to pause for just a minute. Ponder what I'm saying. Ponder what I'm suggesting and pray over it for a little while. My goal with this blog is to offer up the idea that perhaps the scripture is in fact describing the worldwide medical monopoly. And if it's not, then what entity in our world could Daniel be describing? The thing is, it fits like a glove. And while the profession may be peopled by some of the most wonderful, caring, and competent individuals on the planet, and I believe that to be the case, the fact of the matter is the tremendous harm that has resulted to families because of the practice of medicine, well, let's use his imagery, devoured, break in pieces, and stamp the residue with his feet. Consider that our sisters around the world have C-section rates much higher than here in America, Brazil generally being accepted as having the highest rate. And even we are fast approaching the 30% mark for C-sections. Little insertion, this is 2010. The C-section rate is now 32.7%. With some analysts claiming we may double those rates by the next generation, do we honestly believe all of those millions of surgeries are from medical need and necessity? What is the cost in terms of prematurity, recovery, death, and financial burden on families for all of these surgeries? What is the impact on marriages? Did you know that in the 60s, if an American hospital's C-section rate went over 5%, that's 5%, an internal inquiry was held to discover why the rate was so high? What has changed in the last 40 years that all of a sudden caused mothers' wombs to become so inefficient that they need to be cut open in order for the baby to be born? Some claim that all of those women and babies were saved from certain death and supposed uterine prolapse and incontinence by the surgery. Sometimes I have had people share various statistics, quotes, and other evidence that if only our poor, ignorant ancestors had access to medical care, they would have been so much better off. I have thought about these arguments for years and have come up with a test for you to take. If birth was so inherently dangerous, how is it that our ancestors were able to give birth to 8, 10, 12, 15 babies without modern medicine? If birth was so dangerous, how did those mothers make it through birth number one, much less birth number 14? I would like you to take the time to do a study on your own family. Go into any genealogical database and type in your own name. Then go back 5 or 6 generations in your own family. Go down each and every line and just look at your own family history. My guess is that you will see mothers giving birth to baby after baby after baby without prenatal care, without modern medicine, without C-sections, and without birth control. Women's bodies are designed to give birth without drugs and surgery. Sometimes babies died. I believe this was and is more tied to inadequate nutrition, the elements, war, societal instability, and families being on the move than it was to inherent reproductive inadequacy or inability to give birth to healthy children. When mothers live quietly, safely, with access to plenty of fresh food and water, amazing things happen in terms of the number of children born and the overall health of those children. A great place and time to research healthy birth would be in the late 1800s in northern Utah and Idaho. These mostly Mormon rural mothers did not smoke or drink. They lived moral lives, and they birthed huge, healthy families with very little prenatal care, and often just the help of a midwife or two during the home birth. These are the statistics we should be studying to learn what is normal and healthy in birth. What is often flung at home birthing families in terms of statistics is hospital birth stats taken during the Industrial Revolution, either in London or New York. The fact that hospitals at the time only catered to the poor and that those impoverished souls suffered greatly for quality food and the basic necessities of life should make those stats completely null and void when learning what are the normal death rates for mothers and babies during childbirth. The fact is that in healthy women, chances are about 5% that problems will crop up during a home birth. My guess is that the prophet Daniel saw all the families of the earth going to the hospital to give birth, or have the baby aborted away, or in the less free cultures, mothers forcibly sterilized or given forced abortions, which, another little tangent, I believe is right around the corner here in America. Once socialized medicine gets completely set up, everybody's clicking along, we're going to hear, oh, guess what? Can't afford all these babies. Got to get a license to have a child. Oh, you have two kids? Okay, yeah, time for you to get sterilized. Oh, you want to have a third? Nope, sorry, you have to have an abortion. Sorry, we're the government, we're in charge. That is what's coming in America. I know it, I can feel it, and I hope you can feel it too, because we need to stand up and say no. I believe the prophet Daniel, back to my introduction, I believe the prophet Daniel saw mothers locked up in mental hospitals, being forcibly drugged and electroshocked. I believe he saw women using the pill, fathers getting vasectomies, and children being kept for weeks and months in the NICUs. He was so troubled by what he saw that he fainted. I must admit, I have felt faint at times considering the reality of the numbers. It is mind-boggling. When I think of Daniel's pictorial of stamping the residue with his feet, I'm thinking of the babies who do make it through the birthing process, despite numerous drugs and procedures, who then have the formula companies waiting in the wings, and more vaccinations than we have diseases, and then go through life being pummeled by drugs and toxic chemicals in the home and environment. And finally, when old age comes, the most noxious forms of medicine being given and surgeries performed at tremendous cost to the family and society, often days or weeks before the person dies. Could his description of changing times and seasons be tied to babies being artificially induced, or our elderly grandparents' lives being artificially extended for a few more days or weeks? I believe they could be. I believe it is helpful for couples to understand what doctors are being taught in medical school about those of us who have a desire for unmedicated deliveries. Doctors are taught in the second edition, 1965, of Medical, Surgical, and Gynecological Complications of Pregnancy, a textbook which is still much in use, that assertive women are, quote, dangerous, unquote. Here's the full quote. Those patients who consider themselves socially aware are not necessarily more mature, but are trying by their active interest in everything avant-garde, socially as well as medically, to persuade themselves and others that they are. This is the patient who is interested in such methods as natural childbirth, hypnosis, or using childbirth as an experience. The intensity of the demands of the occasional woman who is fanatical in her zeal for natural childbirth and her uncompromising attitude on the subject are danger signals, frequently indicating severe psychopathology. A patient of this sort is not a candidate for natural childbirth and requires close and constant psychiatric support. End of quote. At this juncture, I'm going to stop the show and leave it for the second hour to cover the last half of my introduction. I just want to say that when I typed out this introduction, I was sweating bullets. And the reason why is because the way I think and feel about the medical profession has been so controversial in my family and around my friends that the level of animosity and rejection that's been thrust at me has been so over the top unreasonable that I knew that by publishing these things on the web would bring some distress into my life. I didn't have any idea how much distress it would bring into my life. But these people who run the pharmaceutical companies are very powerful. And they feel like they owe it to their stockholders and to their doctors who they've trained in their medical schools that they run to keep the status quo there, that when you put out the time and money and energy to become a doctor, there's going to be some financial repercussions for you and your family, and that these poor guys who, and men and women, who go $500,000 in debt to become a surgeon, they got to pay off their student loans, and they need to be able to set up a practice, and they need to be able to prosper and practice and do the things that they've been taught to do, and to have a group of women, mostly mothers, standing up and going, nope, not going to do it. Well, sure, you can understand why those people would say, hey, you're crazy. We need to get you on some of our meds because you're crazy, because you don't want what we have to sell you. And let's just say the level of blowback on me and my family has been so over the top nuts these past 5 years since I started blogging that in a way it's kind of been a pat on the back to let me know that I was right. If I was just some nutter psycho patient who wasn't speaking any sort of truth to power for the people who read or listen to what I say, they wouldn't have bothered with me. They wouldn't have wasted 1 second trying to shut me down. But because there has been so many hundreds of attempts to shut me down, close down my blog, shut me up in the chat rooms, and there have been some other attacks as well. You know, it's just confirmation to me that just about everything I've come to in my beliefs about family sovereignty, freedom, and medical slavery have been spot on correct. And, you know, when you have that sort of confidence in the message, it gives you some courage. And the other thing that has truly kept me going has been my faith and the spiritual promptings that I've had around doing this work. It has been unceasing and constant since the day I made the decision to start writing. And when you feel like you got the master of the universe on your side, helping you, giving you courage, healing you when you've been attacked, you know, there's not a whole lot of worldly opposition that can stand up to that kind of support. And it's just given me courage to continue on. So I'll close down this first broadcast, and today, later today, or maybe in a couple days, I'll read the second half of the introduction, just so there's a podcast of it up on the web. I'm doing this mostly for those of you out there who perhaps aren't able to read as well as you'd like, who look at a whole screen full of text and sort of melt down because it's just so overwhelming. Maybe you've got a baby in arms and you're breastfeeding, you don't have time to read something, but you can click on a podcast and listen. I'm doing this for you. And I just want you to know that if you will follow your mother's instinct and your heart, it will lead you to the truth and help you to provide the absolute best birth, nurturing time, and healing for your children. And sometimes that may take you to some places where you didn't anticipate going. It certainly has been the case for me. God bless, and I will be back with the second half of the introduction in just a little bit. Thank you.
Okay.